bank run. Anybody know what happened in Cyprus? What's happening in Cyprus? Yeah, not that I knew. But I had dinner with Barry Eichengreen last night, so now I know. So there were a bunch of us, and it's like, I'm teaching bank runs tomorrow. Talk to me, talk to me, talk to me. So that was from Mary Poppins. And then you can also watch, of course, It's a Wonderful Life and see the bank run in It's a Wonderful Life. Or you can go on YouTube or the news or whatever and check out what's going on in Cyprus, where it's not clear what's happening. But the most recent news, let's see. Yesterday's news was that the EU had put pressure on Cyprus to, so this is my synopsis from my conversation with Professor Eichengreen last night, that the solution to the problem, and I forget how the problem started, was that the government of Cyprus is the Cypriot government, that the Cypriot government had to come up with $6 billion, and so their way, euros, and so their way of doing this was to place a tax on the deposits of people who have funds in the banks of Cyprus. Now, it turns out that most of the money in Cyprus comes not from the citizens of Cyprus, but from Russian oligarchs, as Barry Eichengreen said, who are laundering money. So there's a lot of money laundering that goes through Cyprus. But they couldn't come up with a plan that says, tax the Russian folks who are laundering money and leave the rest of us alone. So they came up with this first plan to tax the deposits. Well, if you're sitting here right now and I tell you, oh, by the way, they're going to reduce the balance in your checking account by 10% tomorrow in order to pay some, I don't know what it is, bill to the Germans whom you don't have a whole lot of fondness for anyway, what would you do with your bank account?
Empty it.
Yeah. And so not surprisingly, there had been the beginnings of runs on the banks in Cyprus yesterday, which is why the banks in Cyprus and the stock market in Cyprus are all closed. So one way to stop a bank is to shut the bank. So they have declared what we called in the 30s a bank holiday. So they've shut down all the banks so that no one can withdraw their funds. In the meantime, the parliament apparently had to pass this bill that called for a levy, a tax, on the balance in the checking accounts, and the parliament today rejected it, 36-0. So nobody voted in favor of it, which is not terribly surprising. And so it's like this old Greek drama that's unfolding. I mean, you know, it's like Sophocles wrote this years ago. So who knows what will happen next. But anyway, all sorts of fascinating things. Not on the agenda for today. On the agenda for today is the U.S. economy in the 20s and the 30s. So we still have pieces to do from last time, which is looking at the economy in the 20s and the 30s, so sort of the background to the Great Depression, and then talking about explanations of the Great Depression. Both today we hit the downturn. We'll start the severity of the Depression, and we'll probably finish up the notes from today on Thursday. It's not my expectation that I'll get through all of today's slides, and we'll finish that up on Thursday. Do y'all have any questions before we jump in? We'll go feet first this time. Opposed to head first. All right, cool. No, because I don't have anything to say. Do you want me to say? I mean, what do you want me to say? So the response, there's a response paper due Friday that you know. And then the question that Rachel had was, do I want to talk about the term paper? Not really. The term paper is due in a month, about, give or take. Make sure that you look at the grading rubric before you get started on it so that you have a sense of what you're expected to do, because that's always your best guide to what you're expected to do. The particular question that had been raised was, were you expected to do your own primary research? So are you expected to do your own econometric research? No. You can, but you're not expected to. So check out what you can find on the rubric, and then once you've read the rubric, let us know what your questions are. I haven't looked at the rubric since I wrote it 5, 6, 8, 10 weeks ago, so I'm not prepared to talk about it. I don't know what's on it. I do have an unrelated question. How many people are in Eichengreen's Econ 191 that meets tonight? I just need to know. Am I seeing anybody else again tonight? Okay, cool. Good. No overlap. I'm doing that tonight, so I didn't know if there was any overlap between that class and this class. None. Okay. Cool. No problem. All right. No questions? Ready to rumble? Here we go. Housing starts. So housing starts hit their peak actually in 1925. Is that right? Yes, 1925. These, now remember, I'm still running off the tables from last week. So the new tables you got don't kick in until about halfway through today's lecture. We're still working off the tables from last week, which were down here as well. So housing starts, you can see in table four down here at the bottom right. They peak in 1925 and then begin their decline. There's some parallels there to what happened currently in leading into the 2007 recession. Housing starts peak again. In the most current period, housing starts peaked before 2007. You can see also the dramatic decline in housing starts. So from a high of 750,000 or more. Why are these numbers look different than those numbers? Oh, I know why. The chart on the left is urban, and the thing on the right is both urban and rural, because those, the numbers, the table and the chart are slightly different, because this peak is at 9-something and this peak is at 750-something. So this is urban and this is both urban and rural. What are housing starts? When they begin building a house, they have to take, who asked the question? When they begin building a house, so it's different than the permits, so you have to take out the permitting process a little bit before. So it's when you actually like break ground or buy the first piece of wood or... So it's the beginning of construction.
Yeah.
Dramatic decline. And if I were to show you, which I'm not prepared to do because I didn't think of it till just a second, the graph for right now, you'd see a similar dramatic decline. But this decline from, for the total urban plus rural, around 900,000 per year down to about 100,000 per year. If I showed you the chart, which you've seen in my other classes if you've had Econ 1 from me, if I showed you the chart for housing starts from 2000 or 1980 to today, it looks very similar to this, with a very sharp rise and an astounding decrease. The difference, one difference between today and the 1930s, is today this line comes down and then bounces along the bottom for about 4 or 5 years. So this one, it hit bottom and then turns around and goes back up. Peter.
What?
1920s, yes. So in terms of mortgages, it was relatively easy to get a mortgage in 1920. One of the things about the 1920 mortgages that distinguishes it from the current period is the practice of getting a mortgage in which every payment went a little bit towards interest, a lot towards interest and a little bit towards the principal that you'd borrowed. So that's called amortizing the loan. That's a New Deal phenomenon. So a lot of the loans that people had in the 1920s were what we call balloon payments or interest-only loans. So they would pay interest only on the mortgage, and then at the end of a 3 or a 5 year cycle, or sometimes 10, they would owe the full amount of principal. And the pattern was typically that then you would go in and refinance. So the bank would give you a loan in 1922. For $5,000, it would be due in 1925. You'd still owe the $5,000 in 1925. You'd go down to the bank in 1925. They would say, oh, this is peachy because your house is now worth $7,000, so yes, we'll reloan you the $5,000. The problem becomes, which is later in this story, but the problem becomes that when housing prices decline, when you're going down to the bank and saying, can I refinance this loan, and your house used to be worth $6,000 and they were willing to write a $5,000 loan against that, if the housing price falls to, say, $4,000, they're no longer willing to write a $5,000 loan against it. And so you had, similarly to today, you had a lot of people who wound up what we say is upside down today, so people who owed more than their house was worth. Now, one of the reasons that housing peaks in this period, in the 1920s and the 1930s, is those immigration restrictions that we talked about last week when Professor Such was here. So remember the 1921 and the 1924 immigration restrictions and the many charts that he showed you, and I know he showed you like 376 charts, but there was one that showed you the pattern of immigration over time and how it goes way up and then it basically collapses, particularly after the 1924 immigration quota. So the restriction on the ability of people to migrate into the United States vastly decreases the new household formation rate. So how many new households are there in any given year? That's a big decrease in the demand for housing. So combined with some bubbles, that had been created through overbuilding. This, I never know whether I'm talking about the 20s or the aughts. Combined with some bubbles that had been created through overbuilding in some areas, that big decrease in the demand for housing is part of what leads to the peak and then the collapse of the housing market. Okay, next picture. What's happening overall in terms of GNP? Overall in terms of GNP, this is table, I can put my glasses on to see what it says. Table 8, good, look like table blob from here. Components of GNP, GNP, GDP in this period are essentially the same for the United States. Remember, the difference between GNP and GDP comes when you have an economy that has a lot of multinationals that are operating in that economy. So in that case, there's going to be a difference between GNP, which is based on the ownership of the resources, and GDP, which is based on the domicile or the location of the resources. For the United States in this period, the differences between GNP and GDP are so tiny, I don't even know what they are, and we don't have to worry about it. So looking at GN total output, GNP, breaking it out into consumption, investment, exports, and government, and then breaking investment down further into inventory investment, so swings in the amount of goods that are held in inventory, and fixed investment, that's the machines and the buildings. This table shows you how much of the drop in GNP in the Great Depression and in the recession before, 1920-21, and the recession after, 37-38, how much of the drop in output was due to each of the components of aggregate demand. So when we look at the 1920-21 recession, very sharp, unemployment goes up. It's only a 13-month recession. Unemployment rises over 10%. But this thing is a real quick, sharp, painful, but very fast adjusting recession. And primarily what's going on in 1921 is it's an inventory cycle. So that positive number of 256 means that the swing in inventories more than explains the total drop in GDP. That if the only thing that had changed was inventories, the change in GDP would have been 2.56 times as large as it was. But the negative sign here in front of consumption tells us that consumption actually was rising during this period. So consumption was offsetting the decreases in inventories, the decrease in inventory investment, which was pushing the economy down. So the typical story about 1920-21, businesses had built up a lot of inventories at the close of World War I, anticipating that prices would rise. Prices didn't rise to the same extent that businesses thought they would. Businesses sold off those inventories, so they decreased their production to sell off the inventories because the bet that they had made on price swings turned out to be a bad bet. So they lay off all of their workers, they sell goods out of inventory. Once they've sold off the goods out of inventory, they rehire the workers and start producing again. So it was basically, oops, we screwed up, we built up too many inventories, we've got to sell out of inventory, we're going to lay you all off until we sell off our inventories. So that's 1920-21. Consumption doesn't decline. If a decline in consumption had been part of the decline in the economy in the 1920s, there would be a positive, not a negative sign in front of the consumption component. Fixed investment, that's the machines and buildings, that's contributing about 50%. Government, like consumption, is a countervailing balance. So government is actually, purchases are expanding. So that's making the recession less bad in 2021 than it would have been if government purchases had not expanded. Contrast that with what happens 1930 to 1933. 1930 to 1933, the first thing is that consumption spending is contributing to the downturn. That means that consumption spending is falling as the rest of the economy is falling. I don't remember if I've shown you the graph or if I've pointed it out. One of the things that was unique about 2007-2009 is it was the first downturn since the Great Depression when real consumption spending fell. So in the Great Depression, the drop in income was so large, or there are other explanations we'll get to, that consumption spending fell. In 2007-2009, consumption spending fell. In all the other intervening recessions, consumption continued to rise, although more slowly, but it still continued to rise throughout the downturn. So the drop in consumption contributes to the downturn in 29 to 30. 29 to 32, inventories are not doing much in terms of explaining why the economy is going down. So this is, you know, 256% of the downturn is explained by inventories in 2021. 3, 4, 20, blech, nothing. The drop in investment is also a part of the story in 29 to 33. So that part of the explanation or where we want to look for stories about why the economy declined is going to come from investment spending. Net exports, teeny tiny. So the drop, there is a drop in net exports. So net exports and GDP are moving in the same direction. That's why there's positive signs in front of all those numbers. So it's not countervailing. It's going in the same direction. But those are tiny, less than 10%. Very, very small part of the downturn is due to swings in net exports. And then in the first 2 years of the downturn, government purchases are actually making the downturn less bad than it would have been if they had done nothing. So government purchases are going up, which helps to offset the problems in the Great Depression. And then in the second part, 32 to 33, the government purchases are contracting, but it's still teeny tiny. So when we look at 29 to 33, the components of aggregate demand that really need to be the components of aggregate demand that we need to focus on to understand what's going on in the Great Depression are really consumption and fixed investment, that is machines and buildings. So inventories are not the story, net exports is not the story, government is not the story, the story is consumption and investment. Peter.
So the net exports
Yep. So when you get people who say, oh, it was all Smoot-Hawley, it was the protective tariffs in the 1930s, and that's why we went through depression. Exactly. For the United States, you point to those numbers, and you say, not a whole lot of this story. Thank you very much. End of, yeah, that's what you do. You know, a little more articulate than, but yes. And then contrast it again with what happens 1937-38, so that's the double dip. In the double dip, the second dip, what do we have? We've got, again, a big inventory swing. Net exports and government purchases are countervailing pressure, so they're keeping the downturn from being worse than it actually was. And declines in investment spending are a big part of the story in 37-38. All right, so let's talk about consumption. One of the things about the 1920s is the consumer durables revolution. When I started graduate school, I wanted to, well, no. When I got to my third year of graduate school and decided that being a straight-up macroeconomist was not for me, because the professors in the macro field were incredibly sexist, and I wasn't going to put up with that kind of crap. And also because I really wanted to talk about issues of unemployment, and I was in graduate school 1978 to 1984, which is that we'd had the first OPEC crisis, 73-75, we had the second one, 79-80, and by about 1980, macroeconomists throw up their hands and say, we haven't got a clue what's going on. We don't know how to explain unemployment and inflation, so let's just assume the economy's always at full employment. Okay. I guess that makes it easier to explain unemployment. It doesn't exist. So I wound up doing economic history and was particularly interested in the Great Depression, and what my advisor and others said was if you really want to understand the Great Depression, you're going to have to figure out the 20s. That if you start in 1929, you're never going to understand the Great Depression. You've got to start earlier. You've got to look at the 1920s to understand what's going on in the Great Depression. So one of the things that I worked on was this consumer durables revolution. The book that's referenced in the other article, Buy Now, Pay Later, is the work that came out of my dissertation. And the consumer durables revolution is the shorthand for saying there was a shift, not a movement along, but a shift in the demand for durable goods starting in the 1920s. So if you just think, you know, standard sorts of, let's draw a picture here and put, say, consumption on the vertical axis and disposable income on the horizontal axis. And yeah, sure, if there's an increase in disposable income, there's going to be an increase in consumption. I'll call that line C1. But what we get is that in the 1920s, this entire line shifts up. So there is an increase, a shift in the demand for durable goods in particular. So you don't see it for non-durables, food and clothing, but you see it for durable goods. So household appliances, furniture, pianos, phonographs, all those things that are studied in the When Your Word Is Not Enough article. The consumer durables revolution comes about, I argue, for two reasons. One is the increase in advertising. And so there was the shift I've described before in terms of the content of advertising and a big push in terms of the volume of advertising, putting these goods in front of the public and convincing folks that these durable goods were things that they needed to complete their family. Fascinating work that's been done by a whole bunch of people on the rise of advertising. And the second piece, which becomes important in terms of understanding the 1930s, is the increase in installment credit. That the consumer durables revolution, the increase by families in their purchases of durable goods, is facilitated by their ability to use credit in order to buy these things. So we talked about installment credit last week when we did the When Your Word Is Not Enough paper. The key parts to this installment credit are that the installment credit is tied to a particular good. So if you're going to buy a piano, you get an installment loan for buying that piano. And if you miss payments or otherwise breach your contract, and I'll come back to that later, if you miss payments or otherwise breach your contract, the sales finance company, so the company like GMAC that wrote that installment contract, has the legal right to repossess the good that you're purchasing. That's still true. All of that is still true. What's unique in the 1920s is that the down payments are substantially large. They're typically about one-third of the total. The terms of these payments, the length, that is, of these contracts, typically about 12 months, sometimes 18 or 24, but typically 12 months. So you get one-third down, 12-month contract. And that means that in contrast to today, when you drive the car off the lot in 1926, you have a car that's worth more than what you still owe on the contract. Today, when you buy a car, you put 0% down, you get a 5 or a 7 year loan, you drive that car off the lot, and the car is now worth less than what you owe on the car. Right? So you have payments and you owe a whole bunch of money on the car, and the car, if you sold the car, you couldn't even get enough money back to pay off the loan. The flip is true in the 1920s. So people are accumulating wealth, they're accumulating equity in these durable goods, even as they're buying them on time. So they buy an $800 car, they finance, oh, I can't divide 800 by 3. They buy a $900 car, sorry. They buy a $900 car, they come up with $300 for a down payment, they finance the other $600. The car doesn't lose a third of its value when you drive it off the lot. It loses like 5 to 10% of its value when you drive it off the lot. And so they have equity, they have wealth in the durable good. Which means that if they screw it up and they don't make their payments and that thing is repossessed, when the car is repossessed, they do cancel the debt. So you no longer owe the debt. But they've taken the car away as well. And if the car is worth more than the debt, that repossession means the family's losing wealth. So if the car is worth $850 and you only owe $600 on the installment contract, they're going to repossess the car when you stop making your payments. They're not giving you back that $250 difference. They're going to pocket that $250 difference. And so there's a big incentive in terms of wealth accumulation to make sure you make the payments, because if they repossess that car, you're going to be literally out some cash. It's not like that you have a loan that's worth more than the car. These days, you know, they repossess your car after 6 months, and you're thinking, that's cool. My brother-in-law did this. You know, my brother-in-law figured he'd had his car for a couple of years. He'd smashed it up a little bit. He still owed a lot of money on the loan. And so he just stopped making the payments on the loan and figured they would come and repossess the car. And he didn't care because he owed like $14,000 on the loan. And the car, he figured, was worth about $4,000. And he figured the joke was on the repo man. Totally opposite case in the 1920s, right? The joke was always on the buyer, that the buyer typically had more value in that car than they owed on the contract. The debt-to-income ratio doubles in the 1920s. So some pictures. This one runs from 1919 to 1939. What color are these lines? The lower line shows you the dollar value of installment contracts. The blue line shows you the debt-to-income ratio. So that's much more interesting, taking the total amount of consumer debt, this is non-mortgage debt, and dividing it by the amount of income. And that ratio, which is measured on the right-hand axis, that ratio is doubling between 1920 and 1930. So there's a doubling in just a decade of the amount of consumer debt in the economy. To put that into a longer-term context, this shows you from 1919 through today, the debt-to-income ratio. And so here's that first decade where we get that doubling of the debt-to-income ratio, and it gets up to about 9%. So double it again gets us to 18%. So the next doubling doesn't happen until the mid-1990s. So it doubles to 9% in the 1920s in just one decade, and then it takes 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 65 years for that debt-to-income ratio to double again. Right? So huge, fast increase in installment debt. How does that compare with residential mortgage debt? This picture was non-mortgage debt. How does that compare with mortgage debt? Here's mortgage debt, and the lines are showing you here, 1919, 1929, give or take. Oh, yeah, because I had to work to figure out which years were which. And 1939. And so you can see here also that there's this big increase in mortgage debt in the 1920s. All right, consumption spending in 1930. The interesting thing about consumer spending in 1930 is that consumer spending between 1929 and 1930 drops in nearly all categories. So Stan Liebergott did work, now passed on, Stan Liebergott did work on to take the numbers that we had that's on consumer spending and push them back a little ways. And using work that he did and work that the Bureau of Economic Analysis did, you can look at, as you break down that C of C plus I plus G plus net exports into its various components, was it just a couple of places in consumer spending that declined? And the answer is no. It's a relevant question because one of the things that consumers are paying for that's captured here in personal business is the fees they pay to stockbrokers. So even though a relatively small share of the population was involved in the stock market in the 1920s, estimates vary from 5 to 20% of the population was involved in the stock market. So it's a relatively small share of the population that's in the stock market. They were undertaking large numbers of transactions. The last graph that I showed you on Thursday, today's Tuesday? Or is today Thursday? I have no idea. Today's Tuesday. I had to do one of those little scratch-off hang tags today on my car to park. I didn't know what day of the week it was. So I'm hoping I don't get a ticket. I like scratched off three different dates because I was like, I have no idea. I'm teaching today. That's all I know. Important things. Anyway, if you look at the amount that people paid to their stockbrokers for those various purchases and sales of stocks, that's captured here in the personal business category. And so it's interesting to see whether or not the collapse of consumption in 1929 to 1930 is simply because people stopped buying stocks, and it's not. That decrease in consumption spending is across the board. It's in virtually every category of consumption spending, with two exceptions down here at the bottom, education and research and religion and welfare. This is the one time that it's relevant to keep in mind that consumption spending is not simply spending by households, but it's spending by households and nonprofit organizations. So consumption spending is spending by households and nonprofits. So they lump nonprofits, who are presumably not motivated by a profit-maximizing incentive, together with households in the recording of these data. And so the very bottom here, the education and research, the religion and welfare, which are increasing in 2930, what that's capturing is it's capturing nonprofit organizations. So nonprofit organizations that are devoted to education and research, nonprofit organizations devoted to religion and welfare. So the bottom line, churches, American Red Cross, that sort of thing, those are increasing their spending. Not a big surprise. The eventual part of research that I've wanted to do for 30 years, and hopefully I'll get to it before I die, is to look at what this is, what this increase in spending by churches is in the religion and welfare. Because certainly the sort of story that we're told is this is churches stepping up and helping the poor, right? That that we shouldn't have, when people, there are sometimes people, Ronald Reagan was one, who said we shouldn't have a federal government safety net. We should do like they did in the 1930s and let the people turn to their families and turn to the churches in order to get relief when they're experiencing poverty. And that would be captured here in an increase in religion and welfare spending. Yep. I don't think Major League Baseball is a nonprofit. Isn't Major League Baseball a profit maximizing? I think they're a profitable corporation. I mean, whether they turn, being a nonprofit doesn't mean that you have zero profit, right? Being a nonprofit means that your goal is never to make a profit. Right. George Steinbrenner is not doing this out of the goodness of his heart. Yeah. The issue is whether or not, today the issue is whether or not your donations to that organization would be tax deductible. So do they have a 501c3 determination letter from the IRS? So whether the MLB has, Major League Baseball has a 501c3 determination letter, I don't know. Yeah, way up high. Robert, right? No.
Rob.
Is there any increase between, any relationship between the rise in inequality and the rise in installment credit? I don't know. It's not a question I'd ever even thought of until more recent times when we all started thinking about inequality more. It would be interesting to see if some of the contemporary work that's being done would apply back to the 1920s. It's harder because the data sets are sparser for the 20s. You really need family-level data. So, all right. What else do I want to say? All right, net investment, negative net investment. So net investment is defined as the difference between gross investment, that's the I that's in C plus I plus G, the difference between gross investment and depreciation. Depreciation is a dollar value that we attach to the using up of machines and buildings in any one year. So it's a it's an accounting thing, an accounting device. People who've taken accounting can be much more precise than I need to be right now. But it's basically a way of saying, look, I'm going to buy this $1,000 overhead here. We think it's going to last 10 years. And so that means a $1,000 machine, 10 years, 1,000 over 10 is 100 years. And so we're going to say that $100 worth of this value of this machine is being used up in any given year. If the purchases of machines simply replace the existing machines, then gross investment and depreciation will be the same. So if the university buys 10 of these things, or has 10 of these things and buys one new one every year, then the net investment would be zero because they're replacing one of these machines every year. When the amount of machines and buildings, machines that are being purchased and buildings that are being constructed, when that amount is less than depreciation, it means that the stock of machines and buildings, the stock of physical capital, is going down. In that case, we have a positive value for gross investment. They're still buying machines and constructing buildings, but they're not replacing the existing stock fast enough. So the total stock of machines and buildings, the total number that exists in a snapshot sense, is going down. So net investment less than zero means that the gross investment is less than depreciation, means that we're not even replacing the amount of capital. If you think back to our wonderful little production function that you love so much, just do this one. What we're talking about is when net investment is negative, that means the K in this capital to labor ratio is decreasing over time. So negative net investment is the same thing as saying the total stock, K, of machines and buildings is decreasing from one year to the next. When net investment is positive, gross investment is more than depreciation, the capital stock is increasing. That uppercase K in the production function is getting larger over time. One of the hallmarks of the Great Depression is that net investment goes negative 1931 through 1934. So the amount of machines that are being purchased and buildings that are being built in 31, 32, 33, and 34 is so small that they're not even replacing the machines that are wearing out and the buildings that need to be knocked down. negative net investment. Government spending. Government spending, here we look at the budget surplus or deficit. So when there is a negative number, it's a deficit. When there's a positive number, there's a surplus. So in this table, the first line, the federal government has a surplus of $1.2 billion in 1929. The state and local governments all combined have a two-tenths of a billion, $200 million deficit. Add together federal, state, and local, and you get a $1.0 billion surplus for all the levels of government combined in 1929. When we're talking about whether government policy is expansionary or contractionary, what matters is not whether or not there is or is not a deficit. What matters is the change from one year to the next. So the budget balance going further into deficit, so moving down to the left, right, along the number line, that's expansionary policy. So if you figure the budget balance, here's your budget balance, here's zero. Down here is deficit, up here is surplus. So if from one year to the next, the government's budget balance, that is taxes minus government spending minus transfer payments, if that budget balance is heading to the left on the number line, that's expansionary policy. If that budget balance is heading to the right on the number line, that's contractionary policy. Did I do that right? I did that right, yes. So the more negative it is, the more spending that's going on, the greater the contribution to GDP, the more jobs are being created and not being sucked back out by taxing. The bigger the surplus, the more contractionary policy is. So what matters is whether or not policy is expansionary, that is whether that deficit is increasing. Policy is expansionary in 30 and 31, thus go from a surplus to a deficit, from a deficit to a larger deficit, but then policy becomes contractionary. So they start to shrink the deficit starting in 32 and then again in 33. We're going to come back and look at a longer span of this data, I think probably on Thursday. Net exports, we already saw in the first chart that net exports are a very small part of the story. Nevertheless, just to get a bead on it, there is a decline in net exports in the 1930s. It's an unimportant part of our story because it's a really small share of the total drop in output. One of the explanations for why net exports into the United States declines, remember that net exports is exports minus imports, has to do with the tariff rate. So tariff rates, that's the tax that is imposed on imported goods. If you want to discourage imported goods from coming into the country, you're going to tax them pretty heavily. So if it costs you an extra $10,000 in taxes to buy a Toyota that's made in Japan, you're less likely to buy a Japanese-made Toyota and more likely to buy a Ford, assuming it's made in the United States. Okay. So what's happening? Well, the average rate on goods is going up. There is an increase in the tariff rate from 28 to 32, so we're becoming more protectionist. That is, we're trying to discourage imports. If we look just at, in the right-hand column, if we look just at the goods that have a tariff applied to them, so when it says the average rate on dutiable goods, it's like, let's ignore all the zeros. There's a whole bunch of stuff we import where there's no tariff, so the tariff rate is zero. Those zeros are included in column one. Those zeros are excluded in column two. If we look just at the goods that have a tariff on them, those rates are going up, 1928 to 1932. That alone, if you just looked at that evidence, you'd say, gosh, shouldn't that be good? Because then wouldn't we be increasing, wouldn't we be decreasing the amount that we're importing? Yeah, except that the United States doesn't operate in a vacuum. So when the United States increased tariffs, then our trading partners all said, well, screw you. If you're going to increase your tariffs on our goods, which is going to hurt our economy, we're going to turn right around and increase our tariffs on American goods, and that's going to hurt you more than you hurt us. And so there were a series of retaliatory tariffs, and that's why the change in net exports hurts the economy, that our exports go down more than our imports go down because of those retaliatory tariffs. But once again, the bigger takeaway is really small part of the story, doesn't do a whit of good in explaining the Great Depression. All right. What were people saying? We don't have time to watch that film. You can watch it. It's in the library. Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? I love it. It's a 1932 British documentary. It's really cool. It was done in July of 1932, so it's after the Bonus Marchers riot on Washington, D.C. That's going to become part of our story on Thursday. So the Bonus Marchers are World War I vets who had been promised a bonus, money, for having fought in World War I. And they were supposed to be paid in, I think it's 1945, and they wanted their bonus early. They were hungry. They were out of money. They had this silly promise from the government that they were going to get money in 1945. It didn't do them a whit of good to get this money 15 years from now. They were hungry now. They wanted it now. They get organized. The World War I vets go to Washington, D.C. They do a huge protest, like we would know today about protests. Not so many of them, but big protest in Washington, D.C. The national federal government calls in the National Guard, and so we've got military shooting military. So we've got current military shooting military vets who were protesting against the government. Huge, huge deal. And what we'll see on Thursday is that bonus eventually gets paid, but this movie starts with those bonus marchers and the riots and the police coming in and so on. It's filmed before Roosevelt is elected. So you don't know which way it's going to go, and so there's some speculation. It's filmed before we have a clue as to what's going on. So they talk about these new theories of John Maynard Keynes. They talk about, is this the collapse of capitalism that everybody has been predicting, and so on. So it's great. That's it. 22 minutes. We don't have time to watch it. Sorry. We watched 3 minutes of Mary Poppins instead. Actually, we had 20 extra minutes of Richard Such instead, but there you go. So, three research questions. The three questions that people ask about the Great Depression. Why did the downturn occur? Why was the depression so severe? So why did GDP drop as much as it did? Which is the same thing as saying, why did unemployment go as high as it did? So why the depth? And then the third question is, why was it so long? So why the length? Why does it take until 1941 for the economy to get back to baseline? So why did we hit a peak and start down in the summer, fall of 1929? Why did we continue going down and go down so very far from then until March of 33? And then why did it take a full decade practically for us to get back to baseline? Those are the three questions. The first one is straightforward. We're going to start on the second one today, finish the second one on Thursday, and then start on the and then hopefully do the third one on Thursday as well. So this is today. This is today, finish it up on Thursday, and this is Thursday. All right, explaining the downturn. Explaining the downturn is not a puzzle, very easy. The downturn, the reason the economy hit a peak and started to turn down was because of the drop in investment spending. Now, we know that housing construction had peaked earlier. Housing construction had peaked circa 1926. But what happened was the bye, Patrick, the Federal Reserve... Yes. Are you ready for the new one? Yeah. Does anybody else need today's handout?
No, I'm just the idiot that grabbed the wrong pile.
That's okay. That's cool. So there's two handouts then. I could have gotten it for you. All right, the drop in investment. The Fed had certainly been aware of the stock market bubble, and the Fed had pressure put on it to raise interest rates to try to tamp down the stock market bubble that we looked at the other day. The Fed resisted doing this for a couple of years and does not increase interest rates until early in 1928. They had resisted for reasons having to do with international relations. So it's a longer story. I'm not going to say much more about it. But the Fed was trying to basically satisfy two masters. One was an international master, having to do with international monetary relations, and the other was a domestic master having to do with the stock market bubble in the United States. Until sometime in 1928, they'd been pretty focused on the international issue, and then they turn and say, ooh, oops, uh-oh, okay. And then they increase interest rates in the United States starting in January of 1928 in an attempt to tamp down the stock market bubble. Well, the higher interest rates have the exact predicted effect. The higher interest rates mean that there's going to be a decrease in investment spending, particularly in purchases of machinery and construction of buildings. So the first piece of this says there's fixed investment is lower due to the higher interest rates. That's straight off from how we explain investment and interest rates. Higher interest rates, not as profitable to buy machines and building and construct buildings as it would have been previously. Fewer machines are purchased. There are some previously profitable projects become unprofitable and are not undertaken at the higher interest rates, blah, 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 blah. Straight off Econ 1. The second piece is what's called the accelerator effect. We don't talk about it very much anymore. It's really a throwback to when all the economists were people who started out trying to be physicists and had failed math 2B or whatever it is, math 7, physics 7B, whatever it is. So a whole bunch of people who became PhD economists in the 60s. First off, if you look at the numbers, there's a surge in the number of PhDs 1968 to 1975. Do you know why? No, not because they couldn't get a job. How old are you?
Vietnam,
that's right. So the way to get a deferment from the draft was to stay in school. So there's a whole bunch of people who stayed in school and got PhDs because then they got not just the four-year deferment while they were getting their bachelor's degree, they got another, they could probably stretch it out to seven-year deferment while they were in graduate school. So there's this huge surge, particularly in men getting PhDs in the late 60s, early 70s. A lot of the guys who got PhDs in economics in that period had started out as physicists. It didn't work out so well. And so we have all this language, right? So we talk about the velocity of money. Wow, where's that from? From this room, right? It's from when they were in physics rooms. We talk about the accelerator effect. What's that from? It's from Lacan, right? It's from when they were in physics. So the idea of the accelerator effect is that it's basically a second derivative issue. So the idea is that investment spending, how many machines a business is purchasing, responds not just to whether sales are increasing, first derivative positive, but the rate at which they're increasing. And so if sales are increasing at, say, 8% per year, that's going to indicate a certain rate of expansion that a business needs. But if sales start to increase, say, only 3% per year, so first derivative still positive, but second derivative negative, if sales start to increase at only 3% instead of 8% per year, you don't have to expand your business as fast in order to be able to keep up with that increasing pace of sales. And so investment's going to decline. You're going to be buying, say, 2 machines a year instead of 3 machines a year. So the accelerator effect says that the amount of investment, how many machines businesses buy per year, is a function not of how many sales they're making, but the rate at which their sales are increasing. And if they start to increase at a lower rate, so increase at 3% instead of 8%, then businesses will buy fewer machines, there'll be a lower amount of investment spending. So it's the decline in the rate of growth that leads to the decrease in investment spending. Residential investment, I mentioned this already. Residential investment was also lower. It had peaked. There had been, gosh, this sounds awfully familiar. There had been overbuilding in the 1920s. Sounds awfully familiar. And with the constriction of demand due to the immigration restrictions, the supply of houses was just in excess of demand for houses, and so that also combined to a drop in residential building. So why the economy turns is not a puzzle. It's actually not very interesting, and nobody studies it because there's really nothing. It's straightforward. It's there. There's no puzzle there. There's no interesting question. It's interest rates got jacked up, and there you go. The really interesting questions are explaining the severity. Why did we go all the way to 25% unemployment? Why did we get this 30% drop in GDP over the course of 4 years? Bunch of old ideas. So by old, I mean the ideas that are 1940s, 1950s, early 1960s, before people really started doing research on this. One was classical labor market analysis. So somebody asked, Peter, I think it was you, about the classical, when we talk about classical school. Classical labor market analysis says we can draw a picture that has the quantity of labor on the horizontal axis and the price of labor, which is the wage, on the vertical axis. And we can aggregate the entire economy into one labor market. Bad assumption. But anyway, we can pretend that there's no difference between one worker and another so that we have one overall demand for labor curve, downward sloping demand for labor, and we have one upward sloping supply of labor curve that reflects how many hours per week people want to work based on various wages. Again, the key assumption here, which is wrong, is that there are that labor is homogeneous. That is, that one worker is just as bad or good as another. That you could, you know, whatever the job is, it doesn't matter who you hire. You can put an econ PhD in there. You can put a sixth grade dropout in there, and you get the exact same productivity from the worker. In that case, in equilibrium, the labor market would clear when the wages were at some level W star, where the supply of labor equals the demand for labor. If we have a problem where there is unemployment means that the wages must be in excess of equilibrium, so find a W1 above the equilibrium, because at any wage W1 above the equilibrium wage, you're going to have a greater quantity of labor supplied than you have quantity of labor demanded, and the difference between those two is going to be unemployment. Labor supplied, that's the people who want jobs. Labor demanded, that's the number of jobs. The difference between the two is unemployment. So this classical labor market analysis said the solution is to drop wages, and that was part of Hoover's thing. So what Hoover was saying was, we've clearly got this problem. Remember, Hoover's the guy who's president. Thank you, Herbert Hoover. Hoover is president from 29 to 33. This is the prevailing thought when he's president. This is the economic analysis that he's getting. And the economists are saying the problem, the reason that unemployment is going from 3 to 9 to 16 to 17 to 20 to 25% is because businesses are holding wages too high. We just need to slash everybody's wages. And if we slash everybody's wages, that'll clear the labor market, and we'll get back to W star and we won't have an unemployment problem. And so after an initial short period in which they advocated holding the line on wages, then starting in 1930, businesses start slashing wages. And you get, modal was a 10% wage cut. So sometimes 7, sometimes 12, but the mode, you know, if you look at these reports that they have on, they would survey businesses and say, did you cut wages, did you raise wages, how many people did you cut wages on, what was the percentage cut, 10%, 10%, 10%, 10%, 10%. So the modal answer is 10%. So it clearly didn't work. Keynes takes some pains to, ooh, that rhymed, to dispel this in the first few chapters of the general theory. You've heard the part of the story, which is that if you decrease the wages of workers, that decrease in the wages of workers means they have less income. If they have less income, they're going to do less spending. If they do less spending, there's less demand for goods. If there's less demand for goods, there's less goods are going to be produced. And so the aggregate effects of this don't work, besides which the key assumption that there's one labor market that can be modeled this way is just bogus. The second old story. So an old theory about the Great Depression that was out there in the 30s and the 40s and into the 50s was business cycle theories. And so you can look up Schumpeter. Schumpeter's first name is Joseph. Joseph. Joseph Schumpeter's, I always say Schumpeter, but you can say Schumpeter. Did this volume, S-C-H-U-M-P-E-T-E-R, S-C-H-U-M-Peter. Schumpeter did the classic volume on business cycles. And oh my gosh, I mean, the business cycle theorists were people, and they had all these fabulous things. I read all this stuff when I was in grad school. It's fascinating. I mean, it's like going back and reading ladies' home journals from the 1920s. And, you know, there were three different cycles. There were really short cycles, and there were moderate cycles, and there were long cycles, kind of like your biorhythms. And that if one cycle went down, but the other two cycles weren't down, then the economy could recover quickly. But in a Great Depression, what happens is the Kuchin and the something else and the Kondratiev cycles all hit the bottom. They're all Ks. They all hit bottom at the same time. So the little cycle, the medium, it sounded like, also I've got the three bears here, don't I? You know, the baby cycle and the mama cycle and the papa cycle. If they all hit bottom at the same time, then Cinderella has no place to sleep. I think I just mixed my... Goldilocks? Goldilocks. There you go. Exactly. That the economy, that if all three of these cycles hit bottom at the same time, then you've got a Great Depression. If only one of them hits bottom at any time, then you have just a downturn, but you don't have a Great Depression. And then they'd have stories about what caused these cycles. And so, you know, there was the sunspot story, which actually, now that we have this whole, like, climate change thing, seems less silly than I thought it was 40 years ago. And they had just, like, 15 different, I remember making a list one time, of 15 different explanations for why these various cycles might exist. None of this was empirical work. None of this was really testable hypotheses. These were just sort of, golly, what do we think? The bottom line of business cycle theorists was you just got to suck it up and wait it out. That it's, you know, your biorhythms go up and they go down. Maybe some exercise will help. No, eat right. But generally, you've got your biorhythms and you just have to sort of deal with it. The business cycles, they go up, they go down. You just kind of have to deal with it. Sometimes we get unlucky. They all three hit bottom at the same time. Yep, it's bad. It's terrible. But just hold on. In a decade or so, we'll be out of it. And that there was a natural boom and bust sort of cycle to the economy. Then we get starting in the 1940s and into the 1950s. We get two competing schools. One are the Keynesian economists. So these are old-time Keynesian economists who are, so Keynes's book is published in 1936. So these are the people who are very, in the first generation, very heavily influenced by Keynes. They're in the first generation. This is before Hicks has drawn the whole ISLM. We didn't even have that IS and LM thing until 1951. So that's the early generation folks. They've read Keynes, and they think the takeaway from Keynes is that there's insufficient aggregate demand, but they've got a pretty simplistic notion as to what that means. I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. The competing group are the monetary economists, the people who are influenced by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz. And Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz had their book, Monetary History of the United States Economy, and that's published in 1963. So these are conflicts and debates that are going on. They're very heated, like late 1950s through 1965, 68 or so. So there's a decade there in the late 50s, early 60s, when there's this conflict between the monetary economists and the Keynesian economists. And they're really in two camps, and they think they have nothing in common. Now, what's happened over the last 50 years is, thank goodness, economic science moves forward, and we've figured out how to pick and choose from both of these two camps that used to think they had nothing in common to figure out what are the good and the bad out of each of these camps so we can craft together a more nuanced story. What I'm going to do, yes, I'm watching my time. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about I'm going to do first the old simplistic story that's the insufficient aggregate demand, and then the more recent work that's focused on the aggregate demand, Keynesian approach, C, I, G, and so on. Then I'm going to talk to you about the money part, so what Friedman and Schwartz said, and then the more sophisticated work that's been done much more recently that goes back and tries to come up with good empirical tests of Friedman and Schwartz. So that's the roadmap we're going down. All right. So the simple stuff. The simplest, this is, say, circa 1960. So 1940s, 1950s, until about 60-ish or so. Is that the Great Depression, if we understand the economy as explained by the Keynesian model, where the amount of output in the economy equals aggregate demand, where aggregate demand is the sum of consumption, investment, government, and net export, then we understand, this is before all the empirical work that we could do today, then we understand the Great Depression as, one, a decrease in investment spending, so the decrease in residential investment and the decrease in purchases of machineries, that kicks off multiplier effects. So we get to round after round after round of decreases in output, decreases in income, decreases in spending, decreases in output, decreases in income, decreases in spending, because people are laid off who used to build buildings or make machines. They don't have as much income. They can't buy as much stuff. They cut back consumption spending. That the government, and this is the takeaway for people who are reading the general theory, that the government could have stepped in and increased aggregate demand by doing expansionary fiscal policy, but that expansionary fiscal policy was not tried. So we'll look at those numbers on Thursday that show that expansionary fiscal policy just simply wasn't tried in the Great Depression. And that the bottom line of all of this is that we could have avoided the Great Depression if fiscal policy had been more expansionary sooner. So the Keynesian, the simple Keynesian story, circa 1950, 1960. Investment went down, kicks off multiplier effects. Fiscal policy wasn't tried. If they'd only done fiscal policy the way they should have, we wouldn't have had the Great Depression. And for these folks, the important policy role for the Council of Economic Advisors, who are in the executive office building, advising the president in the White House on a daily basis is fiscal policy, fiscal policy, fiscal policy. That's the takeaway from this simple Keynesian story of 50 years ago. Now, the pieces that some of us have gone back to are to go back and look at those components of GNP that we had, the same slide I had up here a few minutes ago, and say, look, there's something in these two pieces. Consumption spending clearly dropped, and subsequent work, so not part of this simple story, but a couple decades later, subsequent work said this drop in consumption spending appears to be autonomous. That is, it's not explained by income effects and wealth effects. The simple story said that consumption fell due to multiplier effects, which means that the change in income, and some people would say the change in wealth, that those things caused the change in consumption. The later work said, there's something else. So what do I want to say? Not sufficient. There's something beyond just income and wealth that explains the drop in consumption spending. We need to find something beyond those multiplier effects to explain why consumption fell so much from 1929 to 1933. And then the second story is investment and why investment spending fell. And was it simply the changes in interest rates? No, you just can't explain it from interest rates alone. And so to go back and try to explain investment decline. So this is the more recent work. I'm going to start with consumption. So the three major pieces that have been done to explain the decline in consumption, the first starts with work that was done by Frederick Mishkin, either at the New York Fed or back at Columbia, I forget which. And for some of you, you know him because he wrote a book that you used for some class. So a finance book, or he's got a new macro book out that they're using, I think, in 100B. And didn't he also write a principles book? I don't know. He's written a whole lot of textbooks. So if you do it right, it's the road to riches. If you're like me, it's not the road to riches. It's just like it's the road to a lot of late nights. But anyway, he did it right. So Mishkin says that people cut back their purchases of durable goods more than you would predict from income and wealth effects. That people cut back their purchases of durable goods because they wanted to avoid what he called a distress sale of durable goods. He also used the same theory, by the way, to explain the decline in housing construction. So his story works not just for consumption, but also for the housing part of investment. His notion is that people want to avoid a distress sale. The idea is that if you have to sell your car, let's suppose you have a car. Suppose you have to sell your car by this afternoon. You got to get your car sold by 6 o'clock tonight because somebody you never want me to know about is going to arrive on your doorstep at 6 o'clock tonight and they want cash from you. So, bad guy's coming. So you got to get your car sold and you got to sell it for cash by 6 o'clock tonight. If you got to sell your car by 6 o'clock tonight for cash, can you get a good price from your car? No. Right? You're going to put it on Craigslist with this panic sale. You're going to get some skeezy looking guy who's going to come up and peel off a few $100 bills, and you're going to hold him up and say, I'm going to stop holding him up because he's looking at me weird, and just hope they have that funny little thread in them. So you're not going to get a good price. That's what he calls a distress sale. That if you have to sell your durable goods in a hurry, you're not going to get a very good price. Bless you. That if you can hold on and wait and say, I'm going to sell my car and I'm willing to wait 3 weeks until I get a good offer, you'll get a better price if you can wait 3 weeks. But if you've got to sell it in a hurry because you've got bills that are due, because your kid's in the hospital, because some creep is going to show up at your door and wanting their cash by the end of the night, you're going to lose some of your wealth because you have to quickly sell your durable goods, which means that you want to avoid being put in a position where you're going to have to sell a durable good quickly. And that means you're not going to buy it in the first place. So if the real amount of your debt is going up, so your real debt goes up, if you have nominal debt, I think you can probably identify this through student loan debt. So you have some nominal amount that you owe on student loan debt. And if you divide that by some measure of prices, right, that gets you the real value of your debt. Well, if prices go down, the real value of your debt goes up. That you don't owe any more. So if you've got student debt right now of $20,000, you've got student debt of $20,000. If wages and prices go down between now and 2018, that $20,000 is going to suck up more of your income percentage-wise than it would have if prices and wages had gone up. So if the real value of your debt goes up, you don't want to tie up your wealth in durable goods that you may have to sell in a hurry in order to pay off some of that debt. So if your real debt goes up, or if your wealth goes down. So if the value, if you have, if you're in Cyprus, and you had like $1,000 in your checking account in Cyprus, and then you woke up this morning and you thought, oh, they're going to take a 6.75% tax out of my $1,000 that I had in my checking account. I now have only 900 and some odd dollars in my checking account. That's a decrease in your wealth. So if your real value of your debt goes up, or if your wealth goes down because you had money in those banks that failed, you're not going to want to tie up more of your wealth into durable goods where you could take a real hit if you had to sell those things in a hurry. And so when your real debt goes up or your wealth goes down, you're going to avoid buying durable goods because you don't want to get caught in a position where you have to make one of those distress sales. You're just not even going to buy an appliance or a piece of furniture or a car in the first place. And that's his explanation for why purchases of durable goods go down 1929 to 1932. The implication for Mishkin's story is that people think about their durable goods. They think about their car. They think about their washer. They think about their chest of drawers. They think about their jewelry. They think about their linoleum as an asset that they can sell if they need cash. That they're buying these things because they have value as assets, as opposed to it's better to walk on linoleum than it is to walk on the crud that's on the floor right now. Second story comes from Christina Romer, who's in our department here. And Christina Romer's story is that people will postpone their irreversible purchases that will include both durable and semi-durable goods. And she argues they will do this if there is increased uncertainty. So it's a focus on this distress sale, or on the, you just don't want to have a lot of your wealth tied up in physical assets that may not be worth as much if you have to sell them. So, you know, if I had to take these shoes down, which I don't want to do, I just bought them. If I had to take the shoes down to the consignment store and try to sell my shoes at the consignment store, I'm not going to get anywhere near the $69 I paid Zappos for these shoes, right? So people don't want to tie up their wealth in not just durable goods, but semi-durable goods like shoes as well, when there's uncertainty, when they just are like, I don't know what's going on, I don't understand Paul Krugman's columns, I don't know, but it seems like everybody on CNBC is screaming these days, including that man that screams all the time anyway, right? And so there's just increased uncertainty, I don't understand what's going on, it's just crazy out there, and so forget it, we're not going shopping. It's too stressful, let's get some extra macaroni for dinner. And so the idea there is that people are going to cut back on their purchases of the durable and the semi-durable goods. They're going to shift their spending towards services, let's eat out tonight, and towards non-durables, things like food. And the implication here is that the stock market crash affected everybody. But the stock market crash not only affected the 5 to 20% of the population that had wealth in the stock market, which decreased their wealth and would have decreased their spending, but because it heightened uncertainty, had an effect on everybody. That everybody said, I don't know what's going on, but let's go to Rubio's. Let's not go to Macy's. Baruch. How much did consumption, I missed the key phrase, amongst those?
How much did consumption decline amongst those in work?
In work? No. Wages fell 10%. What? No. So the presumption that you had is that the decline in wages is 10%, the decline in prices is 30%? No. The decline in wages is 10% per year. The decline in prices is 30% over 4 years. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, the real wages, nominal wages are going down with prices. Yeah. All right. Third story comes from somebody you know. That'd be me. And that story is that people were cutting back on consumption in an effort to avoid defaulting on their installment contracts. So This relates to both the When Your Word Is Not Enough article and the stuff I was talking about earlier in terms of consumer durables. And that is that most purchases of durable goods in the 1920s were installment purchases. People were buying them on the installment plan. And if they missed a payment, then these goods were going to be repossessed. And the finance companies did repossess, and most of the repossessions they did were in the first 3 years or so of the contract. Because of the large down payments and the short terms of these contracts, and because the contracts were written in such a way that the surplus, the difference between the amount that was still owed on the contract, in my example earlier today that was $600, and the value of the good, in the example I had earlier today that was $850, that surplus value of $250, the contracts were written in such a way in the early 1930s that that surplus was not returned to the consumer. That surplus was kept by the sales finance company. That meant that people lost wealth. And so the argument that I make is that whether people had an actual loss of income or an expected loss of income, they were going to cut back wherever they could on their consumption spending in order to be able to make those installment payments and to avoid default. In fact, the default rates, the repossession rates, rise, but only a very little bit, nowhere commensurate with the rise in unemployment or the drop in income in the first years of the Great Depression. And as we saw in the previous chart, the decline in consumption spending is across the board. So people are cutting back not just on the durables, not just on the semi-durables, not just on paying their broker, but across the board cutbacks in consumption spending. The loss of income. This relates to work that's been done on debt deflation. So there's an old article by Irving Fisher. Debt deflation something, something, something. I forget the rest of the title of the article. It's probably cited in my piece. And the basic story there is that when you have debt that's fixed in nominal terms, basically the thing I just did. When you have debt that's fixed in nominal terms and your income goes down and you still have to pay that debt that's fixed in nominal terms, that leaves you relatively little money left over for everything else. So if your car payment is $50 a month and your income started out at $150 a month, you had $100 a month left over for everything else. But if your car payment is still $50 a month and your income gets cut to $120 a month, instead of having $100 a month left over for everything else, you now have only $70 left over for everything else. Because the debts are fixed in nominal terms, the percentage decline in consumption spending is bigger than the percentage decline in income. And the way to avoid that, to avoid having that big drop in consumption spending, is to say, screw it, I'm not going to make the payments on my car anymore like my brother-in-law did. I'm not going to make the payments on my car anymore. They can come and repossess the car. But in an era in which people have wealth tied up in their cars, when repossession means loss of wealth, people avoided default. And so the argument is that people cut back on all forms of consumption as a way of avoiding default. Implication is that financial institutions matter, because the extension of the story is what happens in the second dip. By the second dip, there has been a can I use the word revolution again? Probably not. There has been a massive change in legal and political thought. In the 1920s, when these installment contracts were first being written, the feeling was that, I excerpted this in today's handout. So table one in today's handout is the relevant columns from this PDF from the article. In the 1920s, when these installment contracts were first being written, the notion was that people who were not fulfilling their contract, either because they weren't making their payments, or you could breach your contract by taking your car out of the county. So if you bought a car in Contra Costa County, this is going to be hard if you live in the Bay Area. You buy a car and you live in El Cerrito in Contra Costa County, you drive your car a mile across the county border and get to Albany. If you drive your car out of the county, that was often a breach of the contract, because they were worried that people were going to buy these things on installment plan and then skip town and then take the car and drive off. And so the initial penalties are designed to be quite severe, because the notion is the people who are going to be defaulting on these contracts are all these scofflaws and otherwise cheating kind of people who are trying to take advantage of the sales finance companies. And they're people that you want to have these very severe incentives against this morally bad behavior, because if you don't have a big, severe penalty on them for breaching the contract, they'll, you know, these are not people of high moral standards, the story went, all this is in quotes, these are not people of high moral standards, and they would have breached the contract because good people weren't going to be borrowing anyway. Things changed a lot, right? The doubling of the debt income ratio in the 1920s means that by 1929, on the eve of the Great Depression, what had been uncommon a decade earlier was common. 1919, it was uncommon for people to buy a car on installments. 1929, it's incredibly common, and you're sort of a fool if you don't do it that way. And then what happens is the severe default penalties, which you also saw on mortgages in the 20s and leading into the 30s, the severe default penalties, instead of being a strong incentive against morally reprehensible behavior, become a severe penalty against people who have been slammed by the economy. So that you're taking somebody who's been hurt by the economy, who's lost their job, who's a victim of a downturn, and you whack them again by giving them this extremely severe penalty on missing the payments on the on their installment contract or missing a payment on their house contract. Between 1931 or so and 1938, state after state after state changes mortgage contracts and changes installment contracts so that in the case of installment contracts, those surpluses have to be returned. In the case of mortgages, the penalties become less severe for defaulting on your mortgage. And so there's this revolution, I guess. I'm going to call it revolution, a legal revolution that makes the default penalties less severe so that by the time the second dip happens, 37, 38, it's not costly to default on your car loan. That you are not going to lose wealth if you default. Many more people default. Many more people have their cars repossessed. Consumption spending does not experience this autonomous decline in 1938 that it did experience in 1929-30 because of the change in car contracts. That's the story. That's the econometrics. I'm done. See you Thursday. Goodbye.